The Capital Confidential podcast is brought to you by the Times Union, the leading newspaper in New York's Capital Region. Subscribe today or visit online at timesunion.com.
Are there cliques in the polling community? Are like the are the online guys off in one corner, and then you know the heart landline guys are over somewhere else? How does that work?
It's a little cliquey.
You want to deport an undocumented person? Start with me, because I'm an undocumented person.
How do we beat him in an election?
We will. I'm going to run against him.
I wish you would, Dad. I would.
There are things in here that are unobjectionable because they're not that effective. So yeah, sure, I'll vote for a distinctive license plate. Sure, why not?
Jim, you had your press conference at 4 o'clock.
You're having a press conference now?
That's right. I'm having a press conference.
Well, is this your space here or is it public?
No, it's my space.
Oh, this is your
space. Don't interrupt.
I'm David Lombardo, and you're listening to the Capital Confidential podcast. On this episode, we dove into the new Associated Press style guidelines for reporting on polls with Dr. Don Levy, the director of the Siena Research Institute. The new guidelines reiterate some old concepts, like the argument that the mere existence of a poll is not news, and offer takes on new aspects of polling, like online questioning. We talked about reporting on private polls, how to convey results of a poll, and the challenges facing poll aggregators. Enjoy the show. One of the things in the AP guidelines is that a poll needs to be newsworthy, and I'm wondering, from your mind, what threshold does a poll have to hit to become newsworthy? And is this something that you take into mind when you're producing a poll?
I would say by and large, every poll that we do, we feel is newsworthy. You know, we see ourselves here at Siena as contributing to the democratic process here in the state of New York, and that we perform a service. We perform a service whereby we interview a clean sample of New Yorkers about their attitude towards aspects of the government, the economy, issues of the day. And that way, when we provide that information to you and hope that you make it public, we're allowing people from Buffalo to New York City to say, oh, this is how other New Yorkers feel, not just, you know, the people that I work next to or are friendly with, but New Yorkers in general. You know, I guess the question is, what would be not newsworthy?
Right.
You know, there's some things that are so insignificant as to be not newsworthy. But I think, you know, more so my mind goes to if the polling is done in a biased or unprofessional way, then it clutters the public conversation rather than enhancing it.
So how does a reporter identify a poll that's done in a biased or not reliable sort of way?
Well, the first thing is the data and the methodology presented honestly and transparently? Does the pollster tell you, here is exactly what we did and how we did it?
Which is one of the things the AP asks, as you know, they say that the pollster should disclose questions asked, the results of the survey, and the method in which it was conducted.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that would be you know, the line in the sand. I mean, we, you know, in our industry, you know, through our association, American Association for Public Opinion Research, we have what's known as a transparency initiative. And that's really the guiding principle behind it, is when you release a poll, you release every single question in the order in which you ask them. And you make it abundantly clear how you arrived at the sample of people with whom you spoke. If a poll won't do that, then I would immediately question it. And, you know, the famous one, well, the famous methodology is to cherry pick, you know, an interest group, a campaign, someone who is for one specific issue will conduct a poll, and they may jump around the issue in a variety of different ways, and then they'll find one question that they agree with, that makes their point. And then they'll, you know, they'll release that and they'll want you to pick it up and carry it in the paper. But, you know, if they haven't shown you the entire poll and the entire method as to how they selected people, I simply would turn and walk away. I'd ask them for it first. And if they wouldn't provide it, then, you know, I'd say I can't carry that. That's simply not, either newsworthy, you know, in the sort of the second entendre of that word.
So you mentioned the different parties that can conduct a poll, which is also part of the AP's guideline. They say needs to come from a source without a stake in the outcome of its results. And I recently got a press release from a candidate in the 19th congressional district touting their great poll numbers in a head-to-head matchup with FASO, and also pointing out that somebody else wouldn't do as well against FASO. And then I said, okay, can I see your crosstabs? And they then sent me back over essentially the memo they put out, the press release, just referring to it again. And so I never wrote about the poll. I mean, that seems like it's a no-brainer. You don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, that seems exactly right. And I'm not sure that if everybody who has a blog or everybody who is contributing to any sort of publication, online or print, adheres to those standards. You know, some people think a poll is a poll. But I think as we're talking about it, you know, if somebody won't provide you with, you know, the 10, 15, 30, however many questions they ask, you know, exact wording in the order in which they asked them, and then tell you a little bit about the sample, then how can you trust it? Folks will show you, here's the questions we asked, and here's who we asked them of, and oh, by the way, here's who paid for the poll. That allows you, the reporter, to say, well, this is just not something that is objective. I can't publish this.
Is there any context, do you think, where you can use a portion of a poll like that, try to dig something out, even if you're not getting a full look at it, or do you think it's pretty much a hard line in the sand, you don't use it?
Well, I think it's a hard line in the sand, because if what I thought you were going to ask me was, well, so what? So let's say the campaign that you looked at gave you the whole poll. They said, here's exactly what we did.
Okay.
Unfortunately, what happens more often is what you described, where they don't come forward and tell you, here's every question, here's our methodology, but yet they want you not only to publish their poll, but they want you to publish their interpretation of their poll,
right,
which is even one step further along the line. I mean, I think you mentioned that poll to me, and I mean, there was one number in it where one candidate was up by a point or two, you know, and as you know, that falls within the margin of error. There's, you know, strong likelihood that, you know, candidate X is not 1 point ahead of candidate B, but could very well be 1, 2, or 3 points behind, even given the sample that they have.
One of the things the AP guidelines talks about is how you report a lead. And it says, you know, if someone is up at twice the margin of error, you can say, you know, they've got a lead. If someone is within twice the margin of error and the margin of error, you can say they're slightly ahead. And anything less than that, it's close or about even. Do you think those are fair descriptors to use?
Yeah, those are fair descriptors. And that is something that I think a lot of folks who write about polls, they simply don't either understand or want to understand. And to a certain extent, it's not satisfying. Unfortunately, we think of polls perhaps sometimes the same way we think of sports scores. And a one-point lead is a one-point lead. But that's true in sports. It's not true in polling. You know, the manner in which you interpret a poll is as you stated, you know, if indeed candidate A is up by, you know, double or more the margin of error, then with a 95% out of 100 level of surety, you can say that that candidate is ahead. The difference is equal to or less than the margin of error. There's a statistical probability that they are even, or the candidate who's trailing by one or two could actually be ahead. I mean, the margin of error is just that. It's a confidence interval. The polling numbers lie outside of the confidence interval. And a lot of the ones that we do will be at a margin of error of 3 points or 4 points. So a 7 or 8 point lead clearly demonstrates that candidate A is ahead, that there is a meaningful and statistically significant difference between the two. Within that confidence interval, or especially within the margin of error, which is half the confidence interval, then you're looking at what would be more interpreted as too close to call.
What is a good way to quantify the meaning of a margin of error to a reader? Is there a good way to explain, you know, what sort of variation you're expecting and what it actually means?
if you have time within your piece. That's one of the things that...
They never have time. You basically have one sentence to do it.
Right. It's difficult, right? You know, the one sentence explanation, it demands a level of knowledge. So a margin of error of 3 means that the reported score for either candidate A or B could be 3 points higher or 3 points lower. And then you're leaving it to the reader to understand that both those things can happen at the same point, right? You could be 3 points higher while I'm 3 points lower, and thereby you tie me or move ahead of me.
The AP also recommends using surveys with 500 respondents or more. Does that seem like an arbitrary cutoff for you, or does that number mean something to pollsters?
Well, it's debated all the time. It is not necessarily arbitrary, and there are certainly polls that are good quality that are reported with as low as 400 respondents. My personal opinion is I would never go below the 400.
Does it matter what type of race it is, whether you're doing an assembly district, a Senate race, or going as wide as like a statewide race?
Yes and no. Provided that you have a sample that's 400 or your 500 is representative of that entire geography, it would be fine. You have a higher margin of error the fewer number of respondents that you have. So that's the trade-off. A poll of 500 gives you a margin of error of 4.4.
Boom.
So you've got then almost a 9-point confidence interval. If you get up to a 620, that's a 3.9. So then you have an 8-point confidence interval. So it's a difference of 1 point in the size of your confidence interval, which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but in pre-election surveys, it can make a big difference. You know, when you drop down to a total sample size of 400, then the margin of error is up now to 4.9, which gets you really to a 10-point spread. Now, I'll give you one more thing in case anyone is still listening at this point. Now they'll really give up.
Yeah.
Because the next thing you should be concerned with margin of error is whether it does or doesn't consider the design effects of sampling. So think of it this way. If I did a statewide survey of the state of New York and I interviewed 500 people, there is some degree to which I have to weight those people to make them fully representative. I didn't get enough 18 to 29-year-olds. I got, you know, too many upstaters. So the degree to which I statistically adjust respondents, I count one respondent a little bit more than another to make up for the degree to which my sample doesn't match the population, we compute the effect that has on the margin of error. So the more weighting you do to a sample, that increases the size of the margin of error. Not everybody does that. Some people will report their margin of error as if their sample matched the general population identically. A good survey, if you read the note carefully, will point out that the margin of error includes the design effects of sampling.
So doesn't weighting, though, isn't that one of the issues that makes it a challenge to use a private poll from a campaign? Because, you know, I don't know necessarily enough about how they're weighting things, and then they give me something and I'm looking at crosstabs and it might seem fine to me, but in reality they've unfairly weighted it to their advantage?
That can happen, and very few people will tell you exactly how they weighted. I mean, we will tell you whether we weighted to the universe of registered voters, the universe of citizens. You know, those are a little bit different. If indeed we're doing a poll, for example, in a congressional district where we know that historically maybe only 40% of voters have shown up, then we'll tell you that we're weighting to historic voter trends. So we're weighting to the composition of the electorate that has traditionally shown up. Different people may show up this time, but we'll tell you how we did it. So, yes, I think that if you want to up your bar a little bit, then you're going to turn to someone and say, I'm not going to publish your poll unless not only do you give me every question, not only tell me about sampling, but you got to tell me about how you you weighted your sample. And that's especially the case in pre-elections, you know. And oftentimes campaigns will lobby with us. They'll say, hey, you know, this election is going to be different than the last one. you know, we're really expecting a massive turnout in upstate New York, in western New York, because we've got a
Carl Paladino on the ticket.
The Paladino effect, exactly, you know. And
Governor Paladino, sorry.
Yeah. They'll say, well, you should, you know, you should. I'm not going to believe your poll unless you wait to the people that are that we think are going to show up in November rather than the electorate that used to, that showed up, you know, last gubernatorial or the gubernatorial before that. But in the very least, you could make either of those arguments. You could say, I'm waiting to a historic turnout or I'm waiting to a projected turnout because of X, Y, and Z. But again, the pollster ought to make that explicit to journalists.
So does it make sense to report on the subgroups of a poll? You know, my concern is that the sample size might be really small if I'm starting to look at the 500,000 income people or the labor households or whatever, and
right,
then the margin of error could become too large. So, I mean, does it make sense to even report on these subgroups?
We use a rule of thumb that we will not even list a subgroup in our crosstabs unless there was a minimum of 50 respondents in that. Now, 50, there's a huge margin of error. So, you know, we encourage reporters to take that with a grain of salt. And I think that you have to be somewhat leery of it. Oftentimes, this conversation brings in sample size in general. So if you're involved in a poll and it's really, really important to know and understand how people of, let's say, four different income brackets feel towards this issue, and you want to discuss the differences between people making, you know, under 50, 50 to 100, 100 to 200, and 200 and above, you need to try to get a large enough subsample in each case in order to legitimately talk about them with a margin of error that's not in double digits. So that would drive your overall sample, in some cases, well over 1,000. And then it becomes for the pollster, or if the pollster is partnered, let's say, with a media entity, it really drives the cost up. So it's one of those difficult decisions that you have to make. But I think in answer to your question, I would present that information with a grain of salt, with a caveat.
At least one grain.
Yeah, at least one grain. You know, now, you know, if you're just looking at the differences between Democrats and Republicans, then you still have within a sample size of even as low as 500, you still have legitimately sized subgroups that you can comfortably report on.
Should reporters cite an entire question when reporting results? I could see an argument for this because the wording of a question could affect the response. Or should it simply just say Cuomo has a favorable rating, or Cuomo's job approval is XYZ? Should they say, you know, do you this, do you that, or whatever?
I think that's a case by case, right? I think that people who read these sorts of articles have a knowledge of the fave-on-fave question, the job approval question, the horse race question. I think you're really getting into the weeds, and we can go into those weeds on those customary questions because people ask them different ways. Even a question as simple as right track, wrong direction, you know, different pollsters may use slightly different wording.
Which is one of the reasons you shouldn't compare polls, right?
Right, because they're not all the same. Now, it gets really complicated. Let's say you're taking an issue question, pick any, you know, current issue question or even historic one. Are you favor or opposed to, you know, non-Indian casinos in the state of New York, you know, when we were, you know, working through that? And different folks could ask that question slightly differently. And then I think that it would be important to cite the whole question. And if you're going to start comparing one pollster to the next, to point out the differences in the question. Guns. I mean, there's a lot of questions about, you know, support and opposition to, you know, more stringent gun control legislation. And the answer to the question can vary quite a bit based on how exactly the question is worded. Even if you've got two or three pollsters who are trying really hard to ask a fair and unbiased question. On issue questions, a lot of times, we're concerned that not everyone in the electorate spends as much time as you do or I do familiarizing themselves with the issues. So there are times where we have to choose. We have to, you know, how much information are we going to provide so that a person can give you a response? I think that on issue questions, on more complicated questions, then it would be in your interest to cite the entire question to whatever extent you can afford the space.
When it comes to the horse race question in pre-election polling, does it make the most sense to try to focus on trends with the horse race question as opposed to just a snapshot in time? So if you see, you know, one person closing the gap, that's better evidence than random data points that are jumping all around or just like pulling one out?
Again, it depends on how many polls are available.
That's a good point.
You know, I think that the folks who do poll aggregation, although they took it on the chin a little bit in 2016, you know, they serve that function. So if there are quite a few polls on a race, you know, and New York is usually pretty good in terms of statewide because we will do it, Marist will do it, Quinnipiac will do it, and we're not all polling on the exact same day, but between, say, September and Election Day this fall, you know, each of us will poll the gubernatorial race, the attorney general race, several times. And so there, absolutely look at the trends, you know, and that's where your article gets better, of course, because per the AP, you're writing about the race, you're not writing about the poll. And so other things may have happened, you know, there could have been a natural disaster, there could have been, you know, some statements made by one candidate or another. Somebody could have come in and given support or expressed opposition. There's more.
Jim Comey could get involved.
Jim Comey could get involved again. So then you're, you know, you're leading the reader into their own, you know, dialogue with the poll. Well, you know, how'd that happen? You know, Trump just jumped up by, you know, 4 points. Oh, you know, the Comey statement just was put out. Unfortunately, there are instances where, you know, somebody may be the only, and, you know, like we do, as you know, many of the congressional races, we do as many of the state Senate as we can.
And most bless you for that.
Most, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, not everyone says bless you to me when they call, but, somebody, you know, we may be the only one. And then you sit there and go, oh, Sienna just came out and it's, you know, we'll try to do a benchmarking poll and then one, you know, within the last couple of weeks before the election. And so we'll come out with a early benchmarking poll in, say, late September. And, we may be the only number out there on, you know, a CD or an SD. So you have to, you know, so that's it. That's the number. The only other number you're going to get is whatever the campaign has told you. And they'll come out and they'll say, we like the poll or we don't like the poll, or, you know, poll's just a snapshot in time where we're going to work hard, or, hey, those guys don't know what they're doing. Look, they got one wrong someplace yeah. 5 years ago.
Has Rochester been that long ago now?
Yeah, it's been kidding. That long ago. Nobody forgets. Nobody forgets.
So, well, when you're reading these stories that reporters come up with, is there any common, you know, mistake that just drives you insane and makes you start pulling out, you know, what you got left in your hair?
Well, I don't have much left.
I know.
That's
so it's
for sure.
Some reporters have driven most of it away.
They you know, I think so. But not the reporters, I think, and I'm not, you know, trying to, you know, make you feel good, but the guys like you who have been doing this for a while do a good job. Do a good job of telling the story and reporting the poll fairly. You know, where you go crazy a little bit is how the campaigns, some of the statements that they make on the polls, and they want their statement relative to the poll carried with the same veracity as the poll itself or a journalist description of the poll. And it's just
right.
Not, because they're an interest group and they're editorializing one way or another on the poll. That drives me crazy. In terms of reporters, I think the reporters who don't have as much experience and or are just really squeezed perhaps by editorial constraints, who will misrepresent a small lead in a poll and express it, as we were talking earlier, as if it were, you know, the score at the top of the ninth. You know, you turn on the TV and if the, You know, the Red Sox are up over the Yankees by three in the top of the ninth. You know, strong probability, not 100%, but this is different. But margin of error, as many times as we talk about it, as you try to write about it, as I try to confuse people about it, is difficult for folks to understand. They don't remember their stats class from, you know, whenever they took it.
If they took it.
And not satisfying. I mean, it's funny, though, because the weatherman, right, the weatherman's giving you probabilities, right, every day.
Yep. Based on statistical modeling.
Based on modeling, based on the best data that he or she has, and they'll tell you it's a 40% chance it's going to rain. And you go, well, that's not too bad. We'll plan our picnic. And then you go out there and it rains, you know, cats and dogs. And you go, he was wrong. Well, he wasn't wrong. He told you, you know, put 10 marbles in a jar and, you know, four of them are red and the other six are green. Pull one out. Well, you're going to pull that red one out 4 times out of 10. And unfortunately, your picnic was the one that, you know, pulled that marvel.
I think that percentage issue is one of the areas where polls in 2016 got in trouble, and it was because people don't understand percentages. When you say Donald Trump has a 30% chance of winning, well, I mean, 3 in 10 is a good chance. I mean, that, you get in the Hall of Fame if you hit 3 for 10 in the majors.
Exactly.
But people hear 30%, and they're like, oh, well, he can't win. But that's not what it means.
Right.
And that's the aggregators.
I mean, I spoke to some of the aggregators just this past weekend in Denver at our conference, and that's what they said, we're not doing that again, you know, because it sounded like the score was 70 to 30. And if the score is 70 to 30, then, you know, it's pretty close to over,
yeah,
right?
Only the Falcons blow that.
Yeah, that happens one time out of 50, right?
Right.
Yeah, it was a 30% chance. And a 30% chance comes in, oh, by the way, 30% of the time.
And then that's not really an issue for the state coverage, because we don't really have – we're not aggregating the Siena Marist poll. We don't have Nate Silver here, so it's not really an issue here. But I think it's led to the, you know, the lack of trust in polls since 2016.
Right. Well, it's a complicated thing. On one hand, you know, because we speak in numbers – and some people go a little crazy and they start presenting poll results in tenths, which perhaps they believe makes it look even more accurate.
AP does not like that.
Right. Well, it's ridiculous because it's we're just not in a world of tenths, given that we've got a margin of error of 3 or 4 points. People trying to create this illusion of it being so scientifically precise, therefore people should believe it. And it may have backfired on pollsters. And I think we do face a bit of a crisis of legitimacy right now. You know, it's some of it is problems with the work that, A, the aggregators perhaps did in the 2016 election, in some cases because there were races that ended up influencing that election that were under-polled, Wisconsin, Michigan. You know, but then at the same time, there are some people who are actively trying to delegitimize not only pollsters, but statistics in general. You know, fortunately or unfortunately, you know, as you know, our track record at Siena has been quite good over the years. We've had a few that we've missed, and statistically that's appropriate. It's a funny time to be a pollster. You know, we find that the thirst for what we do has never been greater, but the criticism at the same time is more intense than ever before.
And people are less likely to do the poll as well.
Right. That's, you know, that's making it far more difficult, and certainly, you know, makes it more difficult to do. But at some point, the question becomes, are the people who are willing to take the poll different on the variable of interest than the people who won't take the poll? That's the great threat. You know, because of that, we're seeing more and more pollsters experimenting with methods other than calling people up on cell phones and land phones and starting to experiment with online panels, with, you know, other forms of data collection. You know, it's a brave new world in polling. I think that we will see some expressions of some of that experimentation here this fall. In fact, the AP has broken free from the traditional exit polling and has started their own exit polling operation. I'm not sure if you had a chance to review that yet, but Fox and AP are starting an alternative to exit polling that is going to be based not on folks with clipboards standing in key precincts, but rather a combination of telephone and online polling of registered and likely voters from those key precincts. So they're going to be calling up folks, driving them to an online poll, and asking them, have you voted yet? Who'd you vote for? Are you going to vote? If you're going to vote, who are you going to vote for? And they're going to substitute that system for traditional exit polling in this next election.
And that's our show. My thanks to Don Levy of the Siena Research Institute for joining me. You'll see a lot of his work featured in the Times Union this election season. I also want to thank my brother, who I forgot to thank in the first show, for recording the music you hear at the start and end of every episode. If you enjoyed this installment of the Capital Confidential podcast, please subscribe wherever you download shows, including Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, and now we're excited to announce on TuneIn. And if you really enjoyed the show, subscribe to the podcast with someone else's device so they can experience the same happiness this has brought you. Until next time, podcast adjourned.
Just heard, I tried to get you.
Ah! This day sucks!